This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 25th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the palindromic Nelson that is the 111th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Whichever way you look at us, we're looking good. All right, no messing, here's what's on the menu this week. We're heading to New York to check out Rough Trade's new spot in Brooklyn.
We celebrate music from around the world and all its glory, and we encourage people to discover and to sort of step out of their comfort zone. I think that, again, New York really lends itself to that.
Plus, a proposed new independently produced national radio show for the US, which will focus only on the middle states of the country.
It turns out we don't actually understand each other. It's really skewed by the coastal bias of our news organizations.
We're also dazzled by facts, but in unusual form. Having a look at the world of infographics, we find that information is indeed beautiful.
We're all swamped in information on a day-by-day, minute-by-minute basis, so that it feels like there needs to be a solution for us to be able to drink in meaning and information on the fly and quickly.
Plus, prepare to be dazzled by this week's Midori House sessionista, Aoife O'Donovan. We hop the train to Paris to investigate another fine show at the Fondation Cartier. We'll meet the Kenyan music producer, showcasing some of East Africa's best upcoming talent from his own living room. So pour yourself a G&T and pull up an armchair, because all that is coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Kicking us off this week is singer-songwriter Aoife O'Donovan, founder of the critically acclaimed string band Crooked Still, and a singer with a list of musical collaborations as impressive as they are broad, from roots to classical, bluegrass to jazz. From Alison Krauss and Chris Tile to Yo-Yo Ma and Dave Douglas, she released her first solo album, Fossils, earlier this year, and stopped by to see us on her UK tour. And here she is with Red and White and Blue and Gold.
Red and white and blue and gold, I wanna wait for the water to touch my toes. On the beach, the 4th of July, I wanna wait for the fire to burn my eyes. Come on, sit next to me, bury my feet in the sand. There's a hole and it's 12 miles deep, I dug it with my hands. Come on, lie next to me, I'll sing you to sleep, I'll sing you to sleep. There's a band on the boardwalk, you're tapping your feet, I'm too drunk to dance. Black and blue all on my face, I wanna follow you home, I wanna see your place. Wanna take you in my arms and float down a river with you, I wanna buy the farm. Come on, let's run away, baby, let's go, let's go. There's a southbound train pulling out at night, leave this jukebox joint behind. Come on, let's have one more, I don't wanna go, I'm not ready to go. I'm scared of the way that my heart gets sore, wondering if you're mine. Are you mine?
That was Aoife O'Donovan with Red and White and Blue and Gold from the album Fossils. And we'll be treated to two more tracks from that glittering session throughout the show. We've long been a fan of other music and the multitude of independent record stores in the city, and this week a bastion of the UK indie music scene is setting up shop there too. In 1976, Jeff Travis opened Rough Trade in West London to sell the records he'd accumulated around the US. Nearly four decades later, the label that became a shop, that became a brand, has made its way across the Atlantic. Located in the Brooklyn waterfront neighbourhood of Williamsburg, it's 15,000 square feet large and offers a selection of 25,000 curated items. So what does this new retail venture look like, and will it work? Stephen Godfrey, co-owner of Rough Trade, gave Pauline Eiferman a tour as the last shelves were being hammered into place, ready for the grand opening this week.
We had always, you know, harboured an ambition to open a store in New York. And a few years ago, the opportunity presented itself as a result of the success of the stores that we have in London. And Williamsburg at the time was, as it is now, becoming an increasingly popular destination neighbourhood for people who are, you know, really recognise and celebrate authenticity. And it's a very sort of young, average age as a neighbourhood. And again, that suits our customer demographic, and things like the popularity of vinyl are connected with that, you know, celebrating music as an artifact in this, what I would argue, is a post-digital age. So Williamsburg really did fit the bill, and from a sort of commercial point of view, the scale of property available in Williamsburg suited our sort of ambition to open something large.
So why did you choose New York out of all the cities you could have chosen, either in the UK or in the world?
Well, I think New York is very much like London in that it's very cosmopolitan, in that it's a real melting pot for so many cultures and nationalities. And that really suits our type of retail in that we, you know, celebrate music from around the world in all its glory. And we encourage people to discover and to sort of step out of their comfort zone. So again, people who are familiar with embracing different cultures every day, whether that's cuisine or what have you. And I think that, again, New York really lends itself to that. And importantly as well, the music industry is very strong in New York, and having that infrastructure behind you when you're opening something as ambitious as this is very important. So really tapping into that music community that exists in New York is certainly helped.
And speaking of the music industry, it's quite rare to open a music store these days. Can you talk a little bit about how your company is different?
We're very faithful to music. We don't commoditize it. We represent and celebrate it as an art form. And I think that's very important. So when you walk into our stores, you don't see price messaging. You get to see the music in all its kaleidoscopic glory. And I think that that's engages not just artists, but also customers. And we provide as much a place to hang out as it is a place to purchase. So people come to our stores to meet like-minded people and to spend time there. It's not a sort of smash and grab, walk in, walk out. People do spend time, and again, it's very conducive to that. So this store is very unique, I think, in terms of its scale and what it's looking to offer as a sort of rounded experience. So we have a dedicated room that enables record labels to express and tell a story behind a particular release or artist in a way that they've never been able to do before. So from a creative point of view, it offers a fantastic opportunity to record labels and to artists to communicate more than just what is the sound of a release. Being a hangout where people spend time, we have a fantastic food and drink offer in the store, and working with a local company to provide the service there. From a live music point of view, we're partnering with Bowery Presents, and so the live space, which is more dedicated in this store than in our London stores, we share with Bowery, and we will have a duality where our free in-stores that Rough Trade has become very well known for over the years will continue, but in addition to that, we will have ticketed events that will run into the late evening, early morning, run by Bowery Presents. So the space will be busy every single day of the week. It's quite exciting.
And to talk a little bit about the design, you use shipping containers to make a lot of the rooms here. Can you talk about what it will look like?
When we came into the store, the thing that really struck me first of all was the height of the ceilings and the fact that it is a warehouse space or ex-warehouse space. I really wanted to have something that would retain that grittiness and, if you like, pay testament to the area in terms of its history and so forth. And I think having shipping containers achieves that really nicely. And it's quite an unusual space as a result of that. We've modified the containers so they have apertures for windows or what have you, and use them in a way that I guess you could liken to like Lego bricks to create this space and divide the overall space. But it provides a really exciting and unique, stimulating experience. When you walk into the store, there are lots of areas to explore and discover on, you know, a ground floor and on a mezzanine level. And again, I think that's really sort of conducive and reflecting the fact that this is a place to be adventurous, go on an exploration, whether that's discovering new music artists, whether that's discovering a new author, publication, fanzine, or whatever it is. I think this store hopefully overall symbolises that sort of thirst for adventure and that sort of curiosity of mind. Any Rough Trade store, I hope it becomes part of the community and faithfully represents the artists that will be sold here and perform here and speak here. And I think that if people can feel that it's a home from home, whether they are the listener, whether they are the performer, then that's my goal, if you like, to feel that you've provided a place where music as culture can really breathe and express itself in a way sort of free from the really imposing constraints of the commoditization that's happened in recent years.
That was Stephen Godfrey, co-owner of Rough Trade, speaking to Pauline Eiferman at his new shop in New York, which is open now in Williamsburg, and New York's finest television are set to play there this weekend, no less. But it's not all about New York, is it? In fact, it's not all about DC, San Francisco, or LA either. There are plenty of fascinating stories and characters happening away from these cities which deserve a little more attention. So goes the premise of Middle Ground, a proposed new independently produced national radio show for the US, which will focus only on the middle states of the country.
You know, there's a guy in Detroit who wants everyone in America to help find Jimmy Hoffa.
July 30th, every year, we're asking people to go out in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, it doesn't matter, and just dig a hole.
I also learned that when you work a tough job without a lot of recognition or praise, I guess you don't spend time complaining about it.
I just wasn't meeting whiners. Even the trucker, you know, a woman trucker. And I will tell you, Sputter was her nickname, loved her truck.
That's what Middle Ground might sound like if they can raise the cash they need to build a small studio and pay a small team of reporters. The voice you heard was NPR host Celeste Headlee, the brains behind the project. I caught up with her in DC to find out more.
This is Middle Ground. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're going to talk about coal miners, air traffic controllers, and all the other people we rely on without noticing it in just a few minutes. But first, to New Orleans. Listen to this.
The headquarters are in New York and D.C. and L.A., which are the headquarters of finance and politics and entertainment. So obviously they'd build headquarters there, and it makes sense that they would then focus on the regions that are around them. That's where they're closest to. And, you know, financial pressures, quite frankly, in terms of news, have made it very difficult to sustain bureaus in the middle of the country. So as the years have gone by, the news has become more coastally biased. That doesn't mean that they don't cover big news when it's happening in the middle of the country. It means a lot of the lifestyle features a lot of the culture features, the things that help us understand who we are as Americans, are mainly coming from D.C. and L.A. and New York. And that really gives Americans themselves, it turns out we don't actually understand each other. It's really skewed by the coastal bias of our news organizations.
Yeah, I mean, there's that awful phrase that people across the world, I mean, not just Americans.
You're going to say flyover country?
I am, you know, and that presumably is one of the problems that you want to redress. You want to redefine that huge patch of a continent, let's face it, that separates Los Angeles to New York City, right?
And it's one of the first things that many people who visit from Europe say when they come to the United States is, holy cow, this country is huge, right? And yet we regularly fly right over the middle of the country and don't even think about what's going on there until there's a huge story that involves weather, crime, or every 4 years for presidential politics. And that's pretty much the only time we ever visit Iowa.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that there's incredible innovations going on there. Some of our best artists choose to stay there. In our pilot, we speak to Wayne Coyne of the Flaming Lips, and he explains why Oklahoma City, why he stayed there, because he thinks it makes him a better artist and a better human being. So ignoring the middle of the country, I think, actually has serious effects. And you can pardon me if it sounds like I'm going maybe too meta here, but honestly, I think it traces back a little bit of why we're so politically polarized. I don't think we understand one another.
I'm sure it does. I mean, presumably, I mean, the media is precisely that. It's the lens through which we view ourselves, no matter where we're from. And if one region or a huge majority, actually geographically, of the country is underrepresented, then that's almost a criminal thing in terms of how the media works, right? I just want to know, for the Middle Ground Project, is this encompassing everything from news stories to culture stories? It sounds like you're going to run the gamut of news and features, Celeste.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a particularly great problem in that there's way too many stories for us to catch them all, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just always going to end up with more material and more content than we can probably fit. But yeah, we intended to follow all the news, whether it be breaking or otherwise, all the politics and all the culture stories coming from the middle of the country. And there is a lot of it.
And have you been inundated with journalists from those states, from the inland, the interior of the United States, let's call it, who have sort of inundated you with story ideas, with, yeah, it's time that my state, my corner of my state was represented? Have you got a sort of hopper full of amazing ideas and features that you could hit the ground running with once you get up and running?
I can't even tell you. We keep a little folder in my Gmail full of all of the different ideas and the quite literally dozens of people who are already asking for a job from the middle of the country saying, thank God, there's going to be a national show covering my area. But yeah, we have pages and pages and pages of ideas and stories that we want to cover once we get off the ground. Once we get through the fundraising phase and actually are able to do the job that we love, we will be straight out the gate with a ton of really great stuff.
I found that so much was easier here, less hectic, but often just as good. I also learned to love the can-do attitude and the work ethic. Living here has completely changed the way I think about the coast. Here is better.
And practically speaking, how's it going to work? Will it be online? Will it have an NPR license or an affiliate thing? How will people actually listen to it once you get the cash together?
Well, we are not going through one of the networks. That would be NPR or PRI, Public Radio International. We're going to be distributing it through a network that we use here in the States called PRX, which is where a lot of independent productions distribute their content to local stations. There's a lot of local stations that we've spoken with in the middle of the country that want to carry the show pretty much from the moment that it gets launched. But it'll also be archived and streamed over the web as well.
And presumably you've got your pick of the local stations. Is the stuff on those stations really good, or do you want to sort of up the ante on the quality of some of the reporting and presenting as well across the country?
Oh, quite frankly, these stations are putting out incredible work. And these reporters know their area better than anybody who flies in for 24 hours from D.C. can. You'd be amazed at the quality, especially of the investigative reporting, which is done to an extent that many large networks don't have the time or the resources to do. And what I mean is that they will pick up a story that's important in their area, and they'll continue to follow it month after month after each development occurs. So you're really getting a full understanding, a nuanced contextual picture of the story in a way that you just don't get in a 2.5 minute segment on your national report. And they're also finding voices and sources that you've never heard before that are not so-called pundits. Pundit is kind of the negative term in our, among our team, where I say, look, no pundits, because we don't want to hear any more talking heads.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out there that really know what they're talking about. They're living this stuff, that can help people put the news into context based on their very life and how it affects them. We don't need somebody giving their opinion on it.
And what about accents and dialects and things? In the UK, there's a healthy obsession, perhaps, with getting
yeah,
a mix,
you
getting a mix of north and south.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, everyone's going to make a joke about Glasgow. Exactly. Even
yeah.
someone based in DC. You know, but is that the case in the US? Are there sort of quotas, and or is there a considered thing? I mean, it'd be nice to hear some more accents on US news, right?
Absolutely. And believe me, there are many phrases. You know, in the pilot show, we actually address this. There's a dictionary called the Dictionary of American Regional English, the DARE, in which they address this very thing, those words that are only said in certain parts of the country, whether they call the fizzy drink Coke or Pepsi, that whether you call it soda or pop, very much depends on where you grew up. So there are a lot of phrases which are very individual to this very large country, and it's something we want to address head on. You know, that's one of the things that we'll be doing is interacting with the editors of the DARE to kind of teach you how to speak, say, Ohioan or Missourian or Texan. But some of these phrases which are very individual, dagnabbit.
That's our show for this week. Middle Ground is produced by Matt Trevethan, Bridget Chagas, and Chris Godier. Edited by Jacob Conrad. Our executive producer is Sue Goodwin. The theme music was composed by Lucy Michelle in Minnesota. Have a great week, and we will talk again soon in the Middle Ground.
That was Celeste Headley, and you can find more information about the Middle Ground Radio Project online. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Next, we'll be asking how you make information look really, really good.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facades.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. My favourite quote about veracity of information is from the British comedian Stuart Lee, who recounts an argument with a London taxi driver ending with the cabbie's rejoinder, "Well, you can prove anything with facts." So when we heard about Information is Beautiful, a website and competition that celebrates and promotes the elegance and accessibility of infographics, graphs, charts, anything that is a visual representation of information, we wanted to know more. They've just hosted their second Kantar Information is Beautiful Awards, highlighting some of the best work being done in this area around the globe. David McCandless is the founder, and he joins me in the studio now. David, welcome to the Culture Show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Now, I've printed off some things from the website. I should also point out to listeners that David McCandless, I don't know whether he's generally this husky, but you did have your awards bash last night, right?
Yeah, my brain is pulsing with red data points right now.
That's what I like. That's the sort of information, an infographic of a hangover. It's it's a beautiful place to be. Mm-hmm. So are we sort of seeing a bit of a golden age? Is it maybe the fact that information spreads on the net quicker, but the fact that maybe information is shared, but maybe not sort of facts aren't extrapolated so readily because there's such information overload. Is that maybe why we're seeing a bit of a golden age, if we are, in information graphic design?
I believe so. I think it does feel like a golden age. Like you say, we're all swamped in information on a day-by-day, minute-by-minute basis. So it feels like there needs to be a solution for us to be able to drink in meaning and information on the fly and quickly. So that definitely is an element. And also, like, information graphics aren't that new. Florence Nightingale and various other people were playing with them at the turn of the century. But the internet seems to be a certain carrier wave, seems to be a perfect medium for conveying these graphics. And we're all a bit more responsive to design and editorial mixed together these days. The internet is a information design medium, the two blend. And we kind of expect our information to look good, our news to be well designed.
Obviously, we've said in the preface that this is an international scene. We're looking at entries, certainly for your prize and on your website and stuff, that is completely global. But are there sort of hot spots for this? Are there maybe countries that, because maybe their language is unrepresented, that they do their business more in infographics, perhaps?
Yeah, it's interesting. We had quite a range of entries this year. US and UK were generally dominating. Mm-hmm. We had big hotspots, Germany and France, but also interesting moats here and there, like Latvia, Singapore, China, and some from the Lebanon as well. So it's rising around the world. And it's interesting to see how these cultures will embrace it with various variations in alphabets and styles and stuff.
Because I guess there's a difference to typography. There's a picture about something as universal, right? And there's no worry about being able to understand Korean or Arabic or anything else. What about the entries in the actual competition? And we said you're sort of fresh from the awards bash last night. Maybe first tell us about the winner.
Well, we had about 600 entries from around the world, and we distilled it down. We brought it down to one final entry, which was from Bloomberg in the US. And they did an amazing interactive on the world's billionaires. So with this interactive, you're able to drill down into the lives and demographics and backgrounds of the richest people in the world. And it's a stunning, you know, it's an interesting visual piece. It allows you to wander through this data. But it's also a bit of an emotional journey, I found personally, because you start off with awe and wonder, and then you rapidly become envious and jealous. And then you end up with sort of hate and disgust as you are able to burrow into these people's lives. But it's a beautiful example of being able to play with a huge data set that involves people and just endlessly cut and slice and find your own stories.
And the interactive element is obviously something that's enabled by the internet. Are some of the entries presumably 2D things that were printed in newspapers that are simply a pictorial representation of some information?
Yeah, right. We have categories that were specifically in the interactive category, but it won overall. But we also have categories for static infographics, static data visualization, and even tools, because there are more tools arising for people to be able to create them themselves.
And I guess the advantage of an interactive thing is, as you said about the Bloomberg presentation, you can go on a journey into these billionaires' lives. Presumably, what sort of stuff is thrown up? Where they went to school, where they went to, where they live, sort of a geographical educational kind of thing. How many wives they've had.
Yeah, wives.
This kind of stuff.
And how many brothers and sisters they had. So it gives you a little slight psychological impression of their upbringing.
And where there isn't self-correction, there is the hand of God, of the designer. Right. So we were talking about it before. And about when you have to massage information to fit the beauty of the overall design. Do you take that into account when you're judging these things? And I wonder generally how often things are, we might say, tube mapped, where you would get lost if you use the tube map as a map. But it's great for getting the tube, if you know what I mean. Massaging the data to fit the design.
Yeah, I think massaging is definitely a flaw, and simplifying for the sake of simplifying is definitely another pitfall. We when we're judging these, we do look at the sources and the data as well whenever they're presented, and that's a good safeguard. I think whenever you do this approach, you have to twin it with transparency. You have to be open about your data, because like you say, it's very powerful. Data is very powerful, and graphics are very powerful. Combined, they create something that's actually hard to argue with, and it's very convincing. So there's a responsibility that comes with this medium.
Yeah, because there is almost a capability of there being a propagandist element to this. Of you, I'm sure this has been used many times by governments, by companies, presumably to display their information. The more beautiful and striking something is, I suppose, the more persuasive it can be, right?
Yeah, we saw it in the last Obama election. Both sides were swapping blow, you know, trading graphs, you know, smacking each other with these big graphs, trying to outdo, out infographic each other. I think, again, there's a general skepticism when politicians use anything. So when they present an infographic, I think we all take a little step back and we're wary. But like you say, I think it's an interesting field because it's a level playing field. So amateurs, in inverted commas, and studios and big corporates like Bloomberg are all competing in the same space. They're all able to release their graphics online. They're on the same level. So it's actually an opportunity for young or undiscovered talent to actually burst through with just by doing a great piece, by following the rules and just coming through. And
I suppose the Information is Beautiful Awards treats all imposters just the same, right?
Right.
Well, for the time being, David McCandless, the man behind Information is Beautiful, thank you very much. And you should visit informationisbeautifulawards.com to see, I guess, what we've been talking about and go on the journey with the Bloomberg team and those billionaires What's the average number of wives?
I think it's three.
Okay. Yeah. That seems about fair. Yeah. David, thank you very much for joining us. Yet to come here on The Culture Show, more of this week's Midori House session from Aoife O'Donovan. We'll investigate the new Latin American photography show at the Fondation Cartier in Paris and meet the man championing new music from East Africa from the comfort of his living room. Stay tuned. So back first to some live music and to Fossils, the first full-length solo record by Aoife O'Donovan. Aoife talked to Andrew Muller after the session, but first, here she is with Fire Engine.
Fanfare of the firefly didn't come as much of a surprise to you. Nothing does, you know it all, you know everything. Do I know you? Where am I gonna get my light from now? I put a little oil in my lamp, I try to keep it burning, try to keep it man. It's all in vain, it's all for naught, your name is in blue. Cross my hand, where am I gonna get my love from now? I get down on the ground, I put my pebbles in a mound. Gotta dig a little deeper, hide these jewels that I found among the fossils and the fables told to me by my neighbor three blocks down. When you were able, make a sound. The sound of the fire engine, the sound of you pouring the gin. I can hear the ice, I can hear the limes, I can taste it on your lips every time. Where am I gonna get my water now? This river is a running dry, it's a rocky road, it's a little white line. If you prove false,
the funniest one, I think, is oof.
Yeah, I can see that.
The most common one is people who just have no idea what to say, so they just say everything, aofi, like aoife, and it's aoife, so it's really not trying very hard. But my actual biggest pet peeve is when people misspell it by just one letter. They've made the effort, just not quite enough effort. That's what bothers me the most, but we're just, you know, picking here.
You grew up in Boston with about the most Irish name it's possible for anybody to have. Would it be a correct assumption that that culture formed a big part of the music you grew up with?
Absolutely. That culture, certainly. My father is from Ireland. He came to the U.S. in 1980 and met my mom, got married, and I was born a couple years later, and I'm the oldest of four children. Grew up in a very musical household, tons of Irish folk music, but also a lot of other folk music, the music that my dad and mom grew up with as well, Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon and the Beatles and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young, and all that stuff as well played a pretty big part in my musical household.
There was no speed metal phase growing up?
No. Their friends were the coolest. They would come over and drink beers and whiskeys and play tunes in the kitchen. I was like, I want to do that.
It has taken you a long time to get around to making this solo record, but you have said before that the record has existed in your life for quite a long time. Why did it take this long?
I first started thinking about making a solo album back when I was 18 and around the year 2000 or 2001. I put it off, and I'm really happy that I did because I had an incredible decade of performing with a band called Crooked Still and also collaborating with many other artists and being a part of a lot of other albums. That being said, making the album this past year, it was definitely time to do it. A lot of the songs are old, but about half of them are brand new. So it was a nice way to kind of take some old nuggets of songs and kind of revitalize them with a band and with Tucker Martin at the helm producing, and then to sort of have the kick in the pants of let's write a bunch of new songs for this new record that you're making.
So did the way that this dream solo album sounded in your head, did that change? Is it much different from the one you had in your head as an 18-year-old?
It's not. It really isn't. I think when I was 19, I was really getting into folk music at that point, really getting into Americana and traditional music. And at that time, I might have maybe put a couple more folk songs on an album, but I did that then with Crooked Still for five albums. So I kind of got that out of my system to a certain extent, but have taken a lot of those influences from old folk songs, both lyrically and melodically. So I think a lot of people who listen to Fossils will definitely hear a folk stream kind of running through it.
Do you find that there is an overlap between, I guess, those two strands, between the Irish Celtic folk music and Americana? I mean, it would seem logical that there is, given that it all came over on the boats.
I think it's factual that there is. I mean, a lot of those the fiddle tunes and the sort of modes that you hear in traditional music from Ireland and Scotland, they're happier when they become old-time tunes and bluegrass tunes. I don't know why, because people were still living in extreme poverty. But maybe they had a happier outlook down there in the mountains of North Carolina.
I mean, there is on the album, which is not necessarily apparent from the solo acoustic session you've just done, there is more, I think, of a big orthodox country sound than anything you've done before. There's that huge pedal steel on Red and White and Blue and Gold.
Exactly.
Had that been struggling to get out for a while?
You know, it's funny. When I made the record, when I finished recording, and there ended up being pedal steel on pretty much everything, I was like, wow, I think I kind of just made more of a country record than I thought I was going to make. It's not that I was kind of holding in that side of myself. It's just that it didn't, you know, those songs didn't really have a home, and that treatment of the songs didn't have a home until I kind of got together with Tucker and brought in the band from New York, and we kind of got to it.
One of the songs on the album that did have a home of sorts, of course, was Lay My Burden Down, which Alison Krauss had already recorded. Why did you want to do it yourself as well as have her version out there?
I wasn't that keen on doing it at first. It was actually Tucker Martin, the producer, who really sort of urged me to consider recording the song. I kind of thought, oh, it's been done. It was in a film called Get Low. It was on Alison's record. There were two versions that already existed. She did it on the Transatlantic Sessions last year, which was on BBC4. But I'm really glad that I did it, because it's quite a different version than hers. It's a little bit more upbeat and a little bit more hopeful, I think, than somber. There are a couple of ways to look at that song. And I think what we ended up doing with it in the studio with accordion and with that crazy Duane Eddy guitar solo that happens, it kind of took on a new life. And I think it's almost like that's the statement at the beginning of the record. We led the record with it, and I feel good about it.
And so is the plan that your next solo album will be slightly quicker in arriving than the first?
Absolutely. I don't think I'm going to wait another 10 years.
That was Aoife O'Donovan talking to Andrew Muller, and her record Fossils is out now. She's currently playing a few dates around the US. AoifeO'Donovan.com, that's A-O-I-F-E, is where you'll find her. You are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. A new exhibition launched last week at the Fondation Cartier in Paris offers a fresh perspective on Latin American photography since the 1960s. It's a huge project featuring over 400 works from more than 70 artists from 11 different countries, including Peru, Colombia, Venezuela and Paraguay, scenes that have traditionally remained outside mainstream art channels. America Latina has been co-produced with the Museo Amparo in Puebla, Mexico, and Monocle's Paul Noble wrapped up warm and jumped on a Eurostar to take a look for the Culture Show.
It's a very crisp November's day here in Paris, and I'm standing outside the Fondation Cartier. It's a 12-storey, beautiful building, and I've come here to look at America Latina, a sprawling exhibition which takes place over two floors of this building, looking at photographs from Latin America from 1960 to 2013. Let's go in and have a look.
My name is Leanne Sacramone, and I'm a curator at the Fondation Cartier.
So Leanne, we're standing here inside the exhibition. This is the result of over 2 years of planning of work for you. Tell us a bit about how this came together.
Well, it's a very ambitious project. I would say in terms of number of artists, one of the most ambitious projects we've done at the Foundation. We have 72 artists from 11 countries. And there are 5 curators, and between all of us, we've traveled to all of the countries that are represented in the exhibition. Basically, it was teamwork to put this show together and select all of the artists. The selection was based on the time period, of course, because we are dealing with 1960 to the present, and also based on the theme we chose, which is photography and text, with text being somewhere within the image, the photographic image.
So we're in one of the quieter bits of the exhibition. It's the city section. You've arranged this thematically. Tell us how that works.
Yes, we have 4 themes. The first theme is called Territory, and explores the idea of what is Latin America as a geographical construct, and there are many artists in that section that inquire into what is Latin America, who are we, geographically speaking, but also there are many works that deal with identity, which connects up with the last theme. The second theme is the city, and here we have photographers and artists who are exploring the city because we thought that was a very important theme for Latin American artists, seeing that in the last 50 years the cities have exploded in terms of population, and they're places where text and image together reveal all of the contradictions of society, and many artists in this section explore that with humor, with irony, these contradictions. The third section is our artists who inform and denounce. It's called informing and resisting, or informing and denouncing. I guess in English that would be a good translation. Many of the artists in that section are doing just that. And you'll find in this section quite a few works that artists who use imagery from the mass media, from newspapers, to do this.
I am Pablo Ortiz Monasterio, and I'm from Mexico.
And we're standing in front of a very visceral and animated piece of work by you. Just tell us a bit about this picture here.
Well, I don't have that many titles for photographs, but this one has one. It's called Volando Bajo. It translates well, low flying. And, you know, it's a young boy that reacted because he saw that I was going to take a photograph. So when I have the camera in my eyes, I see this guy flying across the camera, and clack. It is a dangerous part of Mexico. You don't go just like that and take photographs. Could be dangerous, because there was another group at my right that were smoking dope, and that's illegal in Mexico. So, you know, I saw all of that and I said, wow, this is wonderful. He was standing in this little banqueta, we say, I don't know the word in English, but he was there just in the wall, and I loved it, and he reacted, and that is one of the gifts that sometimes life gives you. You know, I didn't know if I had the shot, but then I saw the negative and I was, wow, it's sharp.
I'm Suwon Lee from Venezuela.
How do you judge the success of this exhibition overall? Because it's a really big undertaking. There's so many artists and so much of Latin America has been explored here.
Yes, I think they've done a very thorough work, and I think it's a good beginning because it's a first show of its kind here in France, and I think in Europe, you know, this vision of Latin America, and I've done it in a very historical way, you know, portraying all the most important, you know, historical moments and political upheavals that we've gone through. Of course, not everyone has gone through dictatorships and, you know, social movements, but it's been a recurring theme throughout, you know, the recent history. So I think we can get a very good idea of what Latin America is, even if it's not the whole picture. You know, it's impossible to get the whole picture in just one exhibition. That's why we have a team of curators that can select the most emblematic pieces and to give us an idea, and also to invite the viewer and the whole public in general to learn and study more about this continent that has so much to offer.
Thank you, Paul. And the audio in that piece came from works by Annabella Geiger of Rio de Janeiro and Jorge Machi of Argentina. America Latina is on now and runs until next April at the Fondation Cartier in Paris. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Nairobi after this.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Well, in a moment, we'll be closing the show with another track from our own Midori House session. But first, we're crossing to Kenya to meet a man who's also got something of a passion for live music. Lamenting the dearth of East African urban artists on the global scene, award-winning music producer David Blackman Mutami came up with the idea for Nairobi Sessions. It's an online platform for untapped as well as established but not yet out there East African talent, which broadcasts live and unplugged from various locations around the city. But the early recordings were made from Blackman's living room sofa. Thousands of people watched online, and the sessions are rapidly gaining traction, with many East African artists clamouring for a spot and interest from the satellite TV service DSTV to play weekly sessions on air. Reporter Vic Averill met with Blackman to find out more.
Hi and welcome to the Nairobi Sessions. My name is Blackman, and today we're hanging out at the Sierra Lounge at the Diana Centre in Nairobi.
I thought about this for maybe 2 years. Trying to figure out, how do I get this music out? I feel like we needed as much publicity as possible. We needed to get our music out in any possible way, just so we could speed up the process of people understanding that we're not just about, you know, congas and djembes and that kind of thing. We do have an urban music scene and it's flourishing.
Briefly looking at East African music as a whole, why doesn't the music scene here in East Africa, why hasn't it taken off so much as, say West African music or like North African music?
If you go to the extreme west, I guess, so to speak, like Mali, Senegal, the music scene there is huge. But in the sense that their traditional music is big, it's crossed over into, I guess you could say, the west here being Europe and the United States and that kind of thing. And the reason why that has happened is because their sound is very percussive. And I think people from the west find that kind of music very fascinating. And then you have the other West African music that's now big, is like in Nigeria and Ghana. African pop music is huge now. It's crossing over big time. It's, I think, in my opinion, it's the next big thing globally.
So if we then look at the scene here in East Africa, how does that differ?
If you look at Tanzania, for example, Tanzania, the music scene is massive. I don't know what the percentage is in Tanzania, but they have a radio and TV required by law to play a certain percentage of local music in their content every single day. We've been trying to get that to happen in Kenya. It hasn't happened yet. I mean, it's there, but it's not enforced. So what happens is we're still listening to majority music that comes from the West, mostly America.
Oh my, yeah, yeah, oh. Since the day when I first laid eyes upon you, and I knew my life was over, couldn't live another day without your love.
Kanji is a musician and businessman. I think Kanji is pretty much, he's one of the major voices in Kenyan R&B. Somehow he was able to cross over between singing at church and not singing at church. He's a pioneer, I'd say, in music in Kenya. Della is an amazing, amazing vocalist who, I guess her style you could call Afro Soul. I would say she's a perfect crossover between, you know, what we like from Western music and what we like from our own Kenyan African music. And she's found her own nice, neat space right in the middle, and it works perfectly. Blinky Bill is, I would say for me, one of the most interesting musicians of our time. He belongs to a group called Just a Band. Now, Just a Band were Kenya's premier electronic music band. And they actually rose to fame very, very quickly. And one of their biggest songs was a song called Hahe, which had a video of a Kenyan superhero that went viral. When I talk about musicians who can probably fill a stadium, Just a Band can. Oh, 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 oh.
So the future for Nairobi Sessions, where's it going now? I mean, you've clearly broken new ground and put a lot of East African artists out there. What's next?
We're hoping to go international, you know, in a big way soon, in terms of getting musicians from across the continent and eventually globally to come to Nairobi if they're coming to play a show or if they're just passing through. So we want to make this like a hub for musicians passing through and they have to come and perform. And then we're already talking to some people, some TV people approached us and they want to take Nairobi Sessions to TV. We started in March 2013. It's been a few months in. I thought, for me, this was like a going to take a year or two before we got into TV. However, literally 2 months in, after like, we hadn't even done more than 5 episodes before we were approached by the TV network asking if they could put our stuff on TV. So that was very unexpected. I guess the timing was perfect. There is a hunger for new mediums of, for music out there. So it's worked in our favor. Above you.
That was David Blackman Mutami, founder of Nairobi Sessions, speaking to Vic Averill. You can find the channel on YouTube if you want to enjoy some of the performances yourself. And that brings us neatly back to our own session, which ends this week's Culture Show. Next week, we'll enjoy the first ever Midori House session recorded in the dark. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher is back, and I'm sure you can hear the difference. So to play us out, here is Aoife O'Donovan again from her Midori House session. Here she is with Beekeeper. Thanks for tuning in.
You ask me why I didn't send you the notes. I threw my pen and ink overboard with what I wrote. Oh, just like a dove or a mirror, a shower, a little black crow. I wanna know all of the ribs in your cage. Too bad your part of me lives in you, and I'm a goddamn fool. Make you move or get out of the game, get out of the game. At the end of the tunnel I can see the lights. Promised you I wouldn't go down without a fight. I know it won't black and white, 'cause there are demons and things that go bump in the night. So swallow your bitter pill. You said you were a thrill seeker. Well, what's your thrill? It's the way you walk, it's the way you stand still, and the way that you look. The sky's turning black and I'm stuck in you like a thumbtack. Between my legs and my arms, you've been long. No, I won't hurt you, just wanna charm you. Wanna be there, I wanna be there. I won't let you go. A beekeeper, a thrill seeker, hit the ground running, told you so.
Thanks.